Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Now, these days, reviewers and critics are increasingly wearied by the tide of target-marketed fiction flooding their desks. The international world of books is in many respects as ruthlessly commercial as that of pop or mainstream cinema. Expect any day now the arrival of pen stars, where six comely young people are locked away and coached towards the production of a series of best-selling novels. The proliferation of new publications alone makes it hard to spot a jewel in their midst. Yet a novel published quietly in December has met with unanimous acclaim from the battle-weary scribes of the book pages. He has created a novel that lives and breathes as convincingly as the characters who inhabit it, said the Irish Times. This great and moving novel, which looks so quiet and provincial, opens out through its small frame to our most troubling and essential questions, said the Observer. What his fiction achieves is a kind of perfection, said the Independent. What these indicate is the belief of many that They May Face the Rising Sun is the supreme achievement of a very modest man. It is with special pleasure that we welcome tonight Mr. John McGahern. Before we begin to talk, maybe I would ask you, if you would, to read for us. You're going to read a few extracts for us from That They May Face the Rising Sun and perhaps one or two other of your novels. So perhaps you could start in the here and now with a little reading from That They May Face the Rising Sun. The glasses are going on. And maybe set it up for us and tell us what it is we're about to hear.
Well, it doesn't need much explanation since it's the opening of the novel. And if it doesn't explain itself, you have lost the reader immediately. James A. Visits the Rutledge, and he comes in without warning. Such was his continual expectation of discovery that in his eavesdropping, he was nearly always disappointed by the innocence he came upon. "Hello, hello, hello," he called out softly in some exasperation. Jamesy, they turned to the voice with great friendliness. As he often stole silently in, they showed no surprise. "You're welcome. Ye are no good. I have been standing here for several minutes and I haven't heard a bad word said about anybody yet. Not a bad word. We never speak badly about people. It's too dangerous. It can get you into trouble." "Then ye never speak, or if ye do, the pair of yous are not worth listening to." In his dark Sunday suit, white shirt, red tie, polished black shoes, the silver hair brushed back from the high forehead and sharp, clean features, he was shining and handsome. An intense vividness and sweetness of nature showed in every quick, expressive movement. "Kate." He held out an enormous hand. She pretended to be afraid to trust her hand to such strength. It was a game he played regularly. For him, all forms of social intercourse were merely different kinds of play. "God hates a coward, Kate," he demanded, and she took his hand. Not until she cried, "Easy there, Jamesy," did he release his gently tightening grip with a low crow of triumph. "You are one of God's troopers, Kate. Mr. Rutledge," he bowed solemnly. "Mr. Murphy." "No misters here," he protested. "No misters in this part of the world. Nothing but broken down gentlemen. There are no misters in this house either. He that is down can fear no fall." "Why don't you go to mass then, if you're that low?" "What's that got to do with it? You'd be like everybody else round here by now if you went to Mass. I'd like to attend Mass. I miss going. What's keeping you then? I don't believe. I don't believe. None of us believes and we go. That's no bar. I'd feel a hypocrite. Why do you go if you don't believe? To look at the girls. To see the whole performance. He cried out and started to shake with laughter. We go to see all the other hypocrites. Kate, what do you think about all this? You've hardly said a word. My parents were atheists, Kate said. They thought that all that exists is what you see. All that you are is what you think and appear to be. Give them no heed, Kate, he counseled gently. You are what you are, and to hell with the begrudgers. The way we perceive ourselves and how we are perceived are often very different, Rutledge said. Pay no heed to him either. He's just trying to twist and turn. When Thought was married, he pissed in the bed and thought he was sweating. His wife thought otherwise. He'd get on as good as any of them, Kate. He took pruning shears from his pocket and placed them on the table. Thanks, he said. They were a comfort, pure Sheffield, great steel. I bought them from a stall in the Inniskillen market one Thursday, Kate said. They weren't expensive. The North, he raised his hand for emphasis. The North is a great place for bargains. Would you like a whiskey, Jamesy, she asked. Now you're talking, Kate, but you should know by now that will ya is a very bad word. Why bad? Look at your man, he pointed to where Rutledge had already taken glasses and a bottle of Powers from the cupboard and was running water into a brown jug. I'm slow, she said. You're not one bit slow, Kate. You just weren't brought up here. You nearly have to be born into a place to know what's going on and what to do. He wasn't brought up here. Oh, not too far off, near enough to know. He wasn't at school, but he met the scholars. Good health and more again tomorrow. The crowd lying below in Shrohan aren't drinking any drinks today. Good luck. What's the news? No news. Came looking for news, he cried ritually.
Now, John, you were in the USA when the book hit the shelves a little bit earlier than planned, and by your own account, that was a bit of a blessing. You still get first night nerves.
Well, I was delighted to be in America, the war was happening elsewhere.
And nobody could ask you too many questions about your book.
That's right.
Or what it was about.
There was a great sense of safety.
Well, you're out in the open now. Now, if I recall, your last novel, Amongst Women, which came out 11 years ago, started out at over something like 700 pages and ended up at around about 300. And you went to 1,000+ on this one and then cut it back ruthlessly. It must have been ruthlessly. Is this the way you work deliberately, or is this just the way it happens?
I don't know. It's the way I work. I'd like to be able to get it right the first time, but I seem to... I think I'm slow, like Jamesy says in the book, is that I just... you have an idea in your head and you keep working till you get it right. In fact, you often get certain passages over a long book and you go back to those like a tuning form and you lean on them for strength in order to get the weaker passages up to where you want them.
And what happens with a book like this? Because what we get at the end of the day is a perfect 300 pages. I'm curious as to what the novel would have been like at, I think, apparently I have read 1,500 pages. What else is in there that we don't actually get to see?
Well, naturally, I'm delighted that you think it's perfect.
I do. Quite perfect. It's the kind of novel you don't want to finish reading.
Well, of course, I'm delighted, and I can only bow. I don't know. Is that you get some good passages? You get some good writing that actually don't belong to the book. That they belong to a different theme, a different idea, and they have to go. Some people that don't fit have to go in the same way. And I mean, I think a lot of bad writing goes as well.
Possibly, but would you have got rid of entire characters? Would they have been excised completely?
Yes.
Many of them?
Yes, five or six main characters.
Significant characters?
Yes.
And because there aren't that many significant or main characters in the actual novel itself.
Well, actually, I mean, it's a very strange thing. It's a very strange process, is that when Adrian Hodge was writing the script for Amongst Women, he seemed a very pleasant man. He rang me up and he complained that the BBC was after him, that there wasn't enough violence and sex in the script. So I was able to give him quite a lot of pages of violence and sex. you know, that I had taken out of the book myself.
Would you be an advocate of what's happening increasingly now with movies, where you get deleted scenes added to the DVD version? I mean, could we at some stage get the DVD version of That They May Face the Rising Sun, all 1,500, or maybe even only 1,200 pages of it?
Well, maybe I'm finding myself working for the censorship board at the end of a long writing life.
I'm curious, though, does it... When you get to the stage in your career where you are an acknowledged novelist, where you are a novelist of enormous stature, where there is no longer any absolute compulsion to get a book into print, I've got to get a book into print, I've got to get a book on the shelves, I've got to be, I want to be a successful novelist, I want to make a lot of money out of writing novels, where you're the kind of person to whom perhaps that kind of thing is not important, that it becomes more difficult to actually let go of a novel.
I know a great deal about writing, but I don't fully understand it. I know that I wouldn't write unless I needed to write. I mean, I'd be quite happy doing something else. I've often thought that I could do without writing, but I'm brought back to it because it's the only way I can make sense of the world. And I've never written anything that hasn't been in my mind for a long time. And sometimes when it's written down, you find that there's nothing interesting there, it disappears. I've often worked for 4 or 5 months and found that what was obsessing me was no use. And then other times you find what you write, it starts to grow into work. And in a way, the material chooses you. And I think that the only reason that you write, or the only reason I write, is because I have to. And I think in that sense that a writer is always a beginner. Though you learn a great deal about technique, and only a fool would do without technique, is that everything new that you start, I mean, that you have problems that you are as if you were beginning again.
And is the process of editing a very, very difficult process? Are there times when you would agonize over, for example, excising an entire character, something you'd really want to hang on to?
Well, you know that it doesn't work. It's by instinct mostly. But I think that an element of criticism has to come into the art, because in a way, you're dealing in a public language. And I think you have to be able to look not only out through the emotions and the feelings and even the ideas, but you actually have to be able to look in as well.
Now, in your earlier novels, a lot of your early novels, the narrative force derives from a central character struggling with destructive forces inside or outside of himself. This book, on the other hand, consists of a year in the life of a rural community, where it's almost a plotless novel. Nothing happens outside of the ordinary. Now, were you aware of the risk involved in attempting to write something like that and in it finding an audience, perhaps?
No, I mean, you never think of risks. I mean, you write what's in your head. And the ordinary fascinates me. I mean, I think that the ordinary is the most precious thing in life. I think that either life is of no value or it's of absolute value. And I think it's of absolute value. And I think that in that sense that a woman combing her hair or a man eating an egg is as important an act as any other act.
So you weren't conscious, or you weren't deliberately setting out to, in any way, write something which was a risky novel. You weren't thinking in those terms at all. You weren't saying, "I've done, you know, I've done with conflict. I've done with tension in novels. I want to try and write a non-conflictual, plotless, tensionless novel and make it work."
No.
I love it when you ask a long question and you get a short answer. It's great, isn't it? All right, we'll move on. So, the point of view in the novel is provided by Joe and Kate Rutledge, more Joe than Kate, and they are blow-ins to a small lakeside community where the novel is set. But in the course of the novel, we actually learn very little about Joe and Kate. Why is that?
Well, they're more or less the chorus through which the various lives happen. I mean, is that the people tell their stories to Kate, and then it becomes gradually obvious, or I hope it would, that these stories are part of a larger story. And it would be wrong if too much of them. Actually, the mask always has interested me, and the chorus. And in a way, in a much smaller way, in Amongst Women, Luke, who you know very little about, whose life is away in England, is in the same position as the Rutledges are, in that they may face the rising sun.
Mm. We do find a little bit about them. There's an episode where Kate's former employer comes to visit, and he introduces an entirely different world, doesn't he? Totally different world.
That's right, but I mean, again, I mean, it's a novel about a community, like, say, Amongst Women was a novel about a family. And I mean, as Luke, in another way, was the outside mask in Amongst Women, is that when Robert Boot comes, he's also a window on that, into that world, and a window out of that world. And basically, there is an argument there that I said about the woman combing her hair, is that Kate is given a chance to go back to London. And I mean, the joys and pleasures of London is celebrated in the novel, but they decide that they're going to stay by the lake because even though with the galleries, the winding river, the stream of people in London, the restaurants, the galleries, is that their lives would be the same, eventually the same as London, as anywhere else.
There's another character, Johnny, who's the brother of Jamesy, and Johnny actually lives in London, and we get a glimpse of his life. But for some reason, for me anyway, the glimpse that we get of his life in London doesn't seem to be as different to the life in the local community, in the Lakeside community, as the contrast that you get with the life that is offered once again to Kate and to Joe Rutledge by Booth.
Well, they'd have a much more luxurious life, but basically, I think the novel says that life is much the same anywhere, and that happiness or the lack of happiness is much more a mental state than it is, you know, through pursuit of, drink or women or money, or when Johnny and Rutledge are driving along, the Shah is pointed out, and he said, they said he was crazy when he bought the old railway line, and now he's a very rich man, and he says, he must be a very rich man, Johnny says, and Rutledge says, he has more now than he needs, but there is only so much he can do with the day. And Johnny says, whose life is almost ending, Johnny says, it may be the whole show. And I think the day is the whole show.
Now, at the center of the novel are two loving, harmonious relationships, the relationship between Kate and Joe Rutledge and between Jamesy and Mary, who are their neighbours, albeit on the far side of the lake. Does that mean, I mean, that is also something that is different to the kind of relationships which you have which you have depicted before. Does that mean that you believe in, you have a belief in enduring love between a man and a woman, that the possibility of happiness?
Well, of course. I mean, I think happiness is the most fascinating subject in the world.
We'll come back to that, because I'm going to ask you to read another bit from the novel which actually deals with happiness. One of the other things about this community, this rural community, you were a teacher. You taught at a classroom. Classrooms, as you know, there's a group dynamic. There is an ethos in a classroom which is dictated by perhaps two or three of the strongest individuals in that classroom, for good or for ill. Is the same thing true, do you think, of a rural community?
I think so. Is that Jamesy says that on one side of the lake is that everybody pulls together and get on wonderfully and help one another, while on another side of the lake that everybody is out for one another and to get as much as possible, and everybody gets on badly. And a book I admire very much, Ernie O'Malley's On Another Man's Wound, when he was an IRA officer going all over the country, he noticed that how the spirit and the intelligence and the whole vigour of a community could change rapidly for the better and for worse over a very small few miles.
And who has the power to shape that kind of community? Is it a quiet man like Joe Rutledge, or is it, in the case of the book, someone like Father Conroy, for example, who would be seen to be more of a civic leader?
I think probably, like anywhere else, everybody needs good neighbours, and a lot of it is luck. I mean, I think a lot of all of life is luck.
Talking about happiness, and why not? I want you to read another extract from That They May Face the Rising Sun, if you would, and this one deals with happiness.
Since I'm accused of not talking enough about happiness,
well, you can talk through your work.
Is that there's a story I like very much, that this woman in aristocratic French society wrote a book about Alexander the Great. And Proust wanted to know from this woman, was Alexander the Great the happiest man in the world, that the world ever had? And she said that she regretted all her life that she didn't talk to Proust about happiness. But that evening, she wanted to dance.
Tell us again, this extract that you're going to read, set it up for us. Tell us what's happening here.
A lot of repetition and ritual takes place in this novel, and every year Rutledge goes round to Jamesy's house to watch the All-Ireland finals with him on TV. And the time of the year is described. September and October were lovely months. The summer ended, winter not yet in. The cattle and sheep were still out on the grass, the leaves turning. The little veg pods on the banks turned black. Along the shore, a blue bloom came on the sloes. The blackberries moulded and went unpicked. The briar leaves changed into browns and reds and yellows in the low hedges, against which the pheasant could walk unnoticed. Plums and apples and pears were picked and stored, or given around to neighbours or made into preserves in the big brass pot. Honey was taken from the hives. The bees fed melted sugar. For a few brilliant days, the rowan berries were a shining red-orange in the light from the water, and then each tree became a noisy infestation of small birds as it trembled with greedy, clamouring life until it was stripped clean. Jamesy arrived with sacks of vegetables and was given whatever he would take in return. When the All-Ireland finals in Crook Park were live on television, Rutledge walked round the lake to watch the match with Jamesy. Jamesy poured whiskey and Mary made tea and sandwiches. The regular striking of the clock served as a cool corrective to the excited commentary. The team Jamesy supported nearly always won. His support completely based on which of the teams he thought most likely to win and provide a triumphant, satisfying end to the year. Once they lost, it was as if his judgment had been impugned. No use, he thrust out his hands. They should have been ashamed to turn out. It wasn't even worth looking at. When the match ended and was talked over for a while, Rutledge and Jamesy, accompanied by the two dogs, walked out to the lake. Thanks for the game. It was great fun, Rutledge said. The right team won this year anyway, he remarked complacently. We'll watch it again next year, with the help of God. The shore was dry, the fallen leaves rustling against his tread. Not until he reached the alder at the gate did he see the Mercedes stationed in front of the porch. Once he entered the house, he could hear his uncle chatting happily with Kate. Will he be able for it, Kate? That's the six marker. They were discussing the sale and transfer of the business. As he listened to the two voices he was so attached to and thought back to the afternoon, the striking of the clocks, the easy, pleasant company, the walk around the shore, with a rush of feeling, he felt that this must be happiness. As soon as the thought came to him, he fought it back, blaming the whiskey. The very idea was as dangerous as presumptive speech. Happiness could not be sought or worried into being or even fully grasped. It should be allowed its own slow pace so that it passes unnoticed, if it ever comes at all. Thank you.
I want to talk some more about That They May Face the Rising Sun, but if we could just move away and perhaps talk about some of your other work. Now, your novels seem to be populated with widowers, and the assumption would be that this is because of the death of your mother when you were very young. What were and what are the abiding legacies for you of her death in terms of your work?
I don't know. Sometimes I think that I might... I think there are many accidents along the way. I certainly think it was the first time I was in love. that world... was taken away. And sometimes I often think if the long and complicated journey of writing isn't a simple instinct to try to recover that lost world, but I'm not certain.
So that, in a sense, that might be what it's about, or part of what it's about, anyway.
It could be what it's about.
Your literary development has a little bit, at least, in common with another great Midland poet and bard, and that's Thurlough O'Carolan, because you benefited. He was fostered out to a family. You benefited from the generosity of another family, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have been a writer without the Moronis. They were a Protestant family. They were incredibly charming. They had a great 19th century library. Old Willie was a beekeeper. He used to always talk about, he was very fond of quoting Plato and St. Ambrose. He called Plato the Athenian bee, the good and the wise, because his words glowed with the sweetness of honey. And he cared about nothing about his about anything in the world but his bees. He wore an enormous beard. You could actually spend the whole evening talking about him. But often the beard covered his, it was full of mustard, it was full of tea. It was often full of bees as well. I remember talking to him once over about a book I had brought back. He drank endless cups of tea and ate bread with raspberry jam, and raspberry jam fell into the beard, which set an enormous buzzing within the beard. And he just walked to the yard and pulled out the bees and cast them into the, without interrupting his conversation. They were so kind of improvident and uncommercial that though they had a rich farm of land, is that they were poor. They used to sell apples. And I was sent to buy apples. We bought them by the bucketful. I remember they were a half crown a bucket. The founder was interested in books. And at that time, there were no libraries. It was very hard to get books. They gave me the run of the library. And I would come with five or six books and take five or six books away. Nobody gave me direction or advice. I read for nothing but pleasure. I think it's still the best reason to read. I read all sorts of books, Scott and Dickens and Cowboys, Zane Grey, and many, many books about the Rocky Mountains. Some person in that 19th century house must have been fascinated by the Rocky Mountains. And I was quite an authority on the Rocky Mountains when I was. Though I was living in North Roscommon.
So when can when can we expect the Rocky Mountain novel? Now, you've already said it, you spend a lot of time working in your novels, thinking about them before you germinating ideas or whatever before you begin to write them, which suggests that you started The Barracks at a very early age. How was it that someone so young could write with such maturity?
Well, I was just trying to write sentences. I don't think I write with great maturity still. I do the best I can. And I was fascinated with words. And a lot of people think that The Barracks is autobiographical, but it's only to a certain extent. Is that the main people in that novel are completely imaginary. And in fact, the idea I had with them is I knew the barrack life well, the daily life, and that's described. The poor guards had to mind a phone that never rang. They had to cycle around roads on which no crime happened. There was no stealing because there was nothing to steal in the country. They had to sleep beside the phone at night, and the phone never rang from one year to the next. I think there was only one prisoner in the barracks in about 8 years. Actually measuring the rain gauge in the morning was a major event. for the Meteorological Service. And in a way, I thought that by creating these imaginary characters, Elizabeth Regan, that you could look at this kind of life and examine it and bring it to life more than if you were dealing with the real people in the barracks.
It wasn't actually your first novel, though, was it?
No, it was. I wrote another long novel before that, and some of it.
At what age? What age were you?
Well, I suppose I was just started. I wrote first without ever thinking of getting published. I think I was the first writer I met at that stage. and in a way, the writing was an extension of my reading. Is that I do believe very seriously that there's not a great deal of difference between the artist and the reader. I think each of us has a private world that others cannot see. And it's with that world that we read. And that the difference between the reader and the artist is that the writer is able to dramatize that private world in his head. But in a way, a book isn't finished until it's actually completed by a reader reading with their private world. And I do believe that quite strongly.
Do you ever feel any reticence at sharing your private world with all of us?
No.
I'll take that as a no, then.
I mean, I think it's a great honour to be read. I think that, in a way, all good writing, I think, is suggestions. And it's not finished, and it's not completed until it's taken up by the reader and then completed. I'm against statements and judgments in that sense.
For two of the men that you write about, Regan in the barracks and Moran in Amongst Women, their participation in the War of Independence seems to have been absolutely crucial to them, because it seems that nothing thereafter was of any significance to them. Would that be correct?
I think that was very common in that generation, is that they risked their lives. They were young. They had a dream of a different country. I suppose those violent years, they were never to live as intensely again. You can see that in an important writer like Ernie O'Malley, that almost his, he had a very interesting life afterwards, but it was almost as if he couldn't write about anything else except the war, which he wrote magnificently about in Another Man's Wound. And also that when they thought it would be a changed country, and nothing was changed much. In fact, it might be even a bit worse than it was before. And then they saw that, and I would have heard many conversations that the church and the medical profession took over the New Ireland. And nothing much had changed. Dublin Castle was gone.
But replaced by?
By the church and medicine. And that's why Moran in Amongst Women is very upset when his daughter wants to become a doctor.
But there's a reticence with these men about talking about that aspect of their lives. And I suppose, one's assumption would be because of all the dark and horrible things that happened. But is that reticence as much because they realise this was the defining moment of their lives and they don't want to go back there because nothing after that would ever be of the same significance again?
I mean, I'm not sure of that, but I mean, people are very reluctant to talk about things that are very important to them. I think that's natural. And people came not so long ago, a couple of years ago, where the famine became fashionable. Would I write about the famine? And I knew one of my grandmothers fairly well that actually must have been a girl through part of the famine. But I never heard the famine spoken about in all my experience, all my life of Irish society, and was, and I think that the war was a little bit like the famine.
Now, the dark, if we could talk about that. The barracks introduced you to the Irish reading public. The dark, however, introduced you to the general public in a very painful manner. For those of us, or for those who don't remember what it was about that book which so upset so many people, the Catholic authorities, Archbishop John Charles McQuaid, what was it about the book that they disliked so intensely?
I mean, they never give reasons. The only close to official explanation to the banning of the book was given by late Professor O'Brien, who was the professor of French in University College Galway. And he was a friend of Con Leventhal, who had been reader in Trinity and was a friend of Beckett's, and he used to go to see them in Paris every year. And they were very upset about the banning of the dark. And Leventhal had a very kind of sore experiences that he got a bit careless about his dress in Paris. And he was given a stiff lecture by the waiter in the Dome Café about his not buttoning his trousers properly. And that this was a respectable establishment. And when Con Leventhal asked Professor O'Brien, who was head of the appeals board or the censorship board, he says, "Have you all gone mad in Ireland banning McGahern's book? Or what's wrong with you?" And Professor O'Brien said, "We can't have people running around the country with their flies open." And I'm afraid Leventhal took this very personally and said that the waiter up in the Dome Café should be on the censorship board.
What do you think upset the authorities most, or at least the Roman Catholic authorities anyway? Was it the dealing with awakening sexuality, or was it the questioning of religion, or was it the questioning of priestly life, or was it equal dollops of the lot, really?
I mean, that's the closest explanation I ever got to it.
Nonetheless,
I had nothing but contempt for the censorship board, and most of the books that the band, like most books published, weren't worth reading, and those that were worth reading could be easily found and quickly passed around, and that there is no taste as sweet as that is forbidden fruit. So in that sense, the censorship board always kind of defeats itself. But I always felt badly about getting mixed up with it. And I actually thought that if I had written the novel better, they mightn't have noticed it. I thought that, there was a time, it's different now, is that it was said that if you were an Irish writer, that you wanted to go abroad, that you should have to go to Paris because of the great examples of Beckett and Joyce and people like that. I always thought that it would be ridiculous for, say, you couldn't imagine a French writer having to go abroad to be a French writer, or an English writer like Larkin or Waugh having to go abroad to be an English writer. I said we could write as badly in Ireland as anywhere else. I was a bit ashamed, and in that sense I was belonged to the first generation to be born into this country. It was our country now, is we wanted to make it as good as we could. We couldn't blame anybody else, and I thought that just with our censorship board and all those kind of, we were making bloody fools out of ourselves, and I was kind of ashamed.
So that's why you didn't get that actively involved in your own defence, I suppose.
No, and when people wanted to protest about it, I mean, in the sense of Beckett's great courtesy, he said you have to read the book first to see what he's, signed the protest. And he said it was a good job when he read it and said he'd be glad to sign. But he said, you must ask McGahern first if he wants the protest. Only for Beckett I would never have been asked. And when I was asked, I was very grateful to the other people and Mr. Beckett, but I said I didn't want to protest because I thought it would be paying it too much attention or honouring it too much. And then when the book was eventually unbanned, I got a telegram from my agent saying, we want you in Ireland, radio, TV, newspapers want to see you. And I stayed where I was, which was in Paris at the time, because because I thought, you know, by making something out of the unbanning would be, again, paying it too much attention. So I didn't protest about the banning in the first place.
But you lost your job. I mean, that must have been very painful.
Well, I did turn up at the school. and that was painful, all right. But that was I thought that was different because that was my civic rights. I mean, the right to earn a living. Actually, it was quite comic. I think I was the calmest person that day. And I was very fond of the people, and I think they would me that I thought would. And I don't think I've ever drank as many cups of tea as that day. And nobody could face it. It was a very kind, I think it must have been a very strange Ireland because the parish priest couldn't face it and he went on holiday. and he had the poor headmaster read out a letter to me saying I was sacked. I met him afterwards and he said, he used to always complain about the bowsies of doctors because they used to stop him drinking whiskey. He says, life wouldn't be worth living if you listened to those bowsies. And he said that, he said to me that you made my life terrible as well as your own by writing that book and getting yourself sacked. Because now he says, I can't walk outside the door, but I'm beset by bowsies of journalists.
The worst manifestation in modern Ireland. Why did you not then, as others have done, and you mentioned some of the names there, reject the Ireland which had rejected you?
I don't think that you can reject anything myself. Is you have only one life, that this is my country. That was the weather of my life. And you make the best you can out of it. There's a poem of Sappho that I like very much where she says, some say our infantry, some more say our cavalry, and some more say our fleet of shining oars is the finest sight on dark earth. But I say whatever one loves is. And there's a comma between loves and is, and I love that line. But I say whatever one loves is. And that's my country.
That was the response of official Ireland. But I think that you reckon the response of the real Ireland and the ordinary people of Ireland would have been rather different. You wrote an essay about the 50s as you remember them, talking about the church's control of almost every area of life. Yet you reckon, and I quote here, that people only gave it a thin veneer of adherence.
That's true. I was talking to, you know, when I came back and lived in the country, I had to learn a new way of living again, I thought it was a remarkable historical imagination where an old friend of mine said that, he says, John, he says, we had the old Druids on our back once, and now we have this crowd. But that was a great sweep.
Was there a bit of divilment in then writing a book or in calling a book The Pornographer, albeit a decade and a half after the Dark controversy? Was there a little bit of sort of, irony there, did you think? Or were you attempting, aiming at that?
No, maybe unconsciously, it was an attempt to write about sexuality, which is probably impossible anyhow. I see pornography as the opposite of human sexuality.
In what sense?
Well, pornography is heartless, it's mechanical, it's inhuman in a way, it's, and everything goes right in it. and in that sense, it's a very old technique as well, is that if you want to look at the sun, you know, look at the shade, and you can actually tell the sun better by its progress in the shade than you can looking up at the sky. And actually, I hadn't read pornography until I came to write The Pornographer, and I found most of it was rather badly written.
And that's actually reflected in the book, because your pornographic descriptions of the sexual act, as opposed to your actual descriptions of the sexual act, they are worlds apart in terms of style and technique, aren't they?
That's true.
Also, The Pornographer is an urban book, and it has an urban feel to it, hasn't it?
Well, it's set in Dublin.
Yeah.
And some people in the country would say
if you're a bad writer, you could still make it sound like sound like Leitrim.
Yeah, well, they say it's an urban activity anyhow down there.
You're going to read us an extract from the Pornographer, just to show the urban feel here.
Actually, it's it's not. It's actually about the country, and in the sense of the pornography, everything is almost always done in terms of something else. And the reason I picked this up, because in a way it leads into the. Those visits in that they may face the rising sun, it deals with an institution called Sunday visiting in the country, and in a way the telephone has done away with it, but I think that anything deep in human nature always takes some other shape. I had now visited, in the sense of doing something in terms of something else, my aunt so often and so regularly in the hospital, that the visits had come to resemble those she was so well used to among relatives on Sundays in the country. Cars pull up outside. Apologies and cautious smiles ease themselves out of front seats. A child slams a back door. Having first discerned who has landed from the cover of the back of the living room, smiles of surprise and delight are wreathed into shape on the doorstep of the porch. Little runs and thrills and pats and chortles go to answer one another till all hesitant, discordant notes are lost in the sweet medley of hypocrisy. Tea is made. The visit ends as it began, relief breaking through the trills of thanks and promises and small playful scolds. And now be sure and don't let it be as long until you come again. We'll think bad of you. Now it's your turn to visit us next time. You've been just promising for far too long. And then each family settles down to a solid hour of criticism of the other. The boring visit ended. It is the way we define and reassert ourselves, rejecting those foreign bodies as we sharpen and restore our sense of self.
I want to talk briefly about amongst women. it strikes me that the children in a lot of your books, if not all your books, show an amazing tolerance of domineering parents or domineering fathers, perhaps. Would that be fair?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think tolerance is the word. I mean, if you're a child, you're powerless and you have no choice.
But yes, but then subsequently, I'm talking about the children when they become adults, that there is still some sort of respect, some sort of love almost, no matter how crushed that love has become.
Well, I think that the parents are your first people, and in a way you can never dispense with them.
No matter how they treat you?
I think it's very difficult.
The representation of amongst women on screen, I gather, I mean, I may be wrong in this, I gather you've never seen it.
No, I didn't see it. I saw the promotional video and I saw that they had done a good job. And I was friendly with Tony Doyle when the book was first published. He and I carved it up for book at bedtime and at BBC. And when it was opened, I went reading at Foyle's in London. There weren't many people there. And Tony and I went across the road and had a drink afterwards. And he had no idea, and I had no idea, that it would become such a success then. And I told him that I wasn't going to look at it. And he didn't mind. You know, I was very sorry when he died. We're friends. And the reason I didn't is that I think... I've written for television, and it's very different writing from writing for novels. I mean, is that the most important person in the movies and TV is the director, because he picks the images. I mean, I think in the sense of writing, the image is the most important single thing in writing. I mean, is that you can pick the images, whether it's a wedding ring or a shoe or whatever, that moves us out of the many images that clutter up reality. And a writer has a different function there. And I actually, you know, was enormously pleased that they made it, because in that sense I thought of it as another reading. And I mean, every person would read it differently and I'd have a very different idea of it. So I would probably be the worst person to look at. And so I didn't look at it.
Would you read a bit of Amongst Women for us?
Actually, this is a passage. I mentioned earlier how that there are certain passages that you lean on in bad times for strength, and that you use it like a tuning fork. And this is a passage from Amongst Women that I used to turn to when it wasn't going so well. And in a way, it's the relationship that the daughters have with the father, and the even more difficult relationship the father has with himself. And the young fella has had a big affair with a girl and has run away. And they try to bring him back, and then he goes off to England, and they can't get him to come back. And the thing about Moran is that he's very unpredictable. So he can be sometimes very charming, sometimes he can be very difficult, so that when he is charming, they feel inordinately grateful. And it's, in a very simple way, it's just complicated. "We're sorry we couldn't get him to come home," Moran said. "That I know you did your best. That's all anybody in the family can do." On the platform, he kissed them as the train drew in. They told him they would be down again before very long. The two sisters were silent as the train crossed the Shannon, travelling through fields. As the train was pulling into Drummond, the small platform black with people like themselves returning to Dublin at the end of the weekend, Mona said in an emotional voice, "No matter what they say, Daddy can be wonderful." Sheila nodded her head in vigorous agreement. "When Daddy's nice, he's just great. He's like no other person. And even the small white stones under the lights on the station platform took on a special glow." Moran went out to the road and closed the iron gates under the yew after returning with the car from the station. He listened for the noise of the diesel train crossing the plains behind the house, but it had already passed. The light was beginning to fail, but he did not want to go into the house. In a methodical way, he set out to walk his land, field by blind field. He had not grown up on these fields, but they felt to him as if he had. He had bought them with the money he'd been given on leaving the army. The small pension wasn't enough to live on, but with working the fields, he had turned it into a living. He'd be his own man here, he had thought, and for the first time in his life, he'd be away from people. Now he went from field to field, no longer kept as well as they once were, the hedges ragged, stones fallen from the walls, but he hardly needed the fields anymore. It did not take much to keep Rose and himself. It was like grasping water to think how quickly the years had passed here. They were nearly gone. It was in the nature of things, and yet it brought a sense of betrayal and anger, of never having understood anything much. Instead of using the fields, he sometimes felt as if the fields had used him. Soon they would be using someone else in his place. It was unlikely to be either of his sons. He tried to imagine someone running the place after he was gone and could not. He continued walking the fields like a man trying to see. Thank you.
I want to finish by coming back to That They May Face the Rising Sun. And there's a character in it, John Quinn. I can hear a hub, a reaction in the audience. He is a womanizing, self-centered, on a couple of occasions, brutal individual who is effectively guilty of marital rape. In another novel, he might have been a tyrannical character. He might have been a Regan, he might have been a Morn. In this novel, he's almost a sympathetic character. Why is that?
Well, I think, since they're stuck with him, they have to put up with him. So they have to do the best they can. And in a way, since he is so outrageous, and since these gentle manners that the people have are fairly strict, to a certain extent, he restores the moral order.
Is he somebody who is perhaps more disapproved of by women than by men?
I think he was, in the novel, the community of the novel generally disapprove of him. But since he breaks the rules, I mean, he actually is a great source of conversation. Since it questions the normal morality is that sexuality is no sin, it's just a healthy sign. But it's almost as if he lacks a moral sense. So to a certain extent, I mean, they have to be very wary of him for their own safety. But they know him, so in that sense, they can't harm them. But it's almost to a certain extent as if in the moral climate of the novel is that they're dealing with somebody who is blind, that he's blind to the normal laws.
There's also an interesting subtext of male communication or non-communication. Is there a sense in which you are saying in the novel that perhaps men communicate far better non-verbally? I mean, there are two characters, the Shah and Frank, who the Shah owns the shop, or a shop, and then hands it over or sells it to Frank. There's no communication between. It's very funny, but there's absolutely no communication between them at all.
That's true. Rutledge does say to the Shah when the whole business has been concluded, though they have been working together, you know, very satisfactorily for years without saying a word to one another. He says, anyhow, the two of you, he says, aren't going to kill one another with talk. And the Shah doesn't blink an eyelid, and he says, you could be taking your life into your hands. So that in that sense, words were dangerous.
And are you in any sense saying that perhaps men have a better, have other ways or different ways of communicating, non-verbal ways of communicating?
No, but I think that there's lots of ways of communicating besides words.
Okay. One of the other characters in the novel, the main characters, I think, in the novel, is nature itself, because you describe beautifully and perfectly almost every month of the year, if not every month of the year, and the way in which the landscape changes around the lake. Is there a touch of the Wordsworth about you? Are you a bit of a pantheist?
I don't think he'd do down in Leitrim.
He needed the Lake District, did he?
No, I admire Wordsworth enormously. I think he's a great writer. I remember the man that gave me my first real job, Donald Gordon, in the University of Reading after I was sacked. I was enthusing about Yeats at the time, and I said Yeats must have been the greatest poet since Shakespeare. And Professor Gordon said very sternly to me, he said, you must pause at Wordsworth. You must certainly pause at Wordsworth. I think the place we live is part of our lives and is important. And I've been always fascinated by water, and in the sense the lake is the mirror of the lives, and it's also the mirror of the sky that we all live under.
We might assume that you are Joe Rutledge, but you've said that real life is too thin for fiction. Well, what did you mean by that?
We're getting into very, very deep waters now. For instance, people think
I've been drowning for the last hour, so.
Oh, you don't look it.
It's just because my hair's not wet.
There are many, it's a very simple thing, is people think that since everybody talks, that dialogue is very easy to write. And in fact, it is the most practically difficult form of writing, that it's very artificial, and it actually gives the impression. But in fact, if you put down the way people talk, it doesn't look like, it looks terrible dialogue, though that's the way they talk. Well, actually, if you look at really good dialogue, is that it just gives the suggestion of people talking, but in fact it wouldn't work as ordinary speech at all. And in the same way, is that whatever is taken from life does grow in the mind. And I think that it takes at least three or four characters to make one character. You know, from the beginning, and that they live so long in the mind that I actually think that a bit of the author is in every one of the characters as well. And that's why I think that a writer can never criticize, in the even sense of John Quinn, any of his characters. His business is the gift of sympathy, and that he never judges them, is that they live in space and time without judgment, as we all do. And in that sense, that he must honour them.
Finally, there's an elegiac quality about this novel. It's actually an elegiac quality that worries me slightly. Is there a sense in which we should be worried because of the amount of time that it takes for you to write a novel, because of your perfectionism, that this might be the last one?
Well, I'm always hoping it'll be the last one. And I feel like writing again, but what happens? When one starts a book, one never knows what's going to happen. And in fact, in a way, I think the writer writes in order to discover something. And I have a feeling that if that tension of discovery wasn't there, it wouldn't be interesting for the readers to, that they would instinctively know that it was just an exercise. And in a way that when you begin something, you're actually trying to find out to see something. I mean, I'd be very happy not to write again, but I think coming back to happiness again, I like the story of Suevo, who was James Joyce's friend, is very witty, and when he was dying, he was in a motor accident. Somebody, some foolish person asked him what was dying like. isn't that a terrible question? And the answer was, which delights me always, is not nearly as bad as writing a novel.
Well, you would make a lot of people very unhappy if you didn't write another novel. John McGarren, it's been an absolute pleasure and a total privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you, Miles, for having me. And thank you all for coming this evening.
Our pleasure.
Okay, now that we've got the routine questions out of the way, it's your turn.
Thank you very much. That was most entertaining and illuminating interview today. When you write, do you write with the reader in view, or do you write just to express yourself? Because when you talked about the last book and you wrote so many characters and then you edited them out, so obviously they meant something to you in the beginning and then you cut them out. Did you cut them out for the reader, or on what grounds?
Well, I think when you begin to write, you know, it's a long process. Is that you're really writing to see? You're writing to, but then I also, I mean, the novel is my favorite form, and one of the reasons is that I think that it's the most of all the art forms. It's the most closely linked. It's the most social. It's the most closely linked to an idea of society. So in the sense of shaping a novel, certainly one certainly sees it from the outside, how it will be seen as a public act. In that sense, I think that the writing is very, it is to a certain extent, it begins as self-expression, but it really has nothing got to do with self-expression when it finishes, if it's any good.
Another question over here, and then we'll take one from upstairs.
John, since Wordsworth was mentioned, I just want to comment on a character who hasn't been mentioned this evening in the book, and that's Bill Evans. Wordsworth wrote a great poem called The Cumberland Beggar. Yes. And the theme of that poem is obviously the way the plight of the beggar elicits so much sympathy from the people in the Lake District in England. And I feel that Bill Evans fulfills a similar role in your novel. Now my question, which has been touched upon by Miles when he used the word elegiac, you've devoted most of your late 50s and the first half of your 60s to writing this book. We've heard about how it's been pruned and changed and altered and so on. But did you not set out indeed to create a certain mood, an atmosphere, which I think is quite unlike any of your other novels. And I do feel it's the novel, and this is meant as a compliment of somebody who is living in their 60s. Because the sense of harmony and peace and tolerance, the begrudgers are on the fringes, and you've talked about the characters, you and Miles, that could, in a differently structured book, create havoc and could provoke tension and violence and so on. You've described two wonderful relationships between two mature couples. And I think also the sense of nature and the community being one. The image that strikes me most in this book, and you return to it more than once, and therefore it's, you know, you're very conscious of what you're doing. Sitting in a room and the sense of a tree invading the room, the world of nature coming inside their houses. And the counterpoint to that, the house, the light from the house moving out into the world of nature so that the room is expanded. I mean, that to me is simply fantastic.
Thank you.
So
now, the problem is, we've already seen that might be all you'll get out of him.
Yes, I'm aware of that, Miles. Yes. But please, could
is there? I mean, sorry, I don't mean to cut you short, but is there a question mark? No.
The question is: did you set out above all else? We've talked about there's no maybe main character. Did you set out above all else to create, to make your peace with Leitrim or Roscommon? This book is going to be on Leaving Cert syllabuses for the next 50, 60 years because it portrays such a wonderfully upbeat, optimistic, is it almost a utopian view of rural Ireland? Or do you really see it as the reality?
Okay. Is it utopian or is it real?
Well, if it's on the Leaving Cert for the next 50 years, that means that I'm guaranteed hatred after my... but seriously, I do think that Scott Fitzgerald said at one stage is that if you begin with an individual, you may wind up with a type. But if you begin with a type, you wind up with nothing. And in that sense, I think that the local is the universal, but without walls. I mean, that's a very different... and I think that particular is the way into the general, it to have any meaning. And there is a scene in the novel which is slightly comic, but it's also true, is that Patrick Ryan and Rutledge are building a shed that never gets built, not even at the end of the novel. and that part of the rafters make squares and rectangles of the skeleton of the roof. And Rutledge remarks that, you know, that they frame the sky and that the actually small space of sky that the rafters frame is more interesting than the whole sky. And then the whole sky grows out more interestingly from that small confined human space. Patrick Ryan says that people got locked up for saying less than that long ago. But I do think that that's what we're both talking about.
Good evening, Mr. McGahern. I'm very curious as to why you took the name Rutledge for your main character in the novel. Be very careful when you answer the question because...
Is your name Rutledge?
Yes. But I don't have a team of lawyers because I can't afford them. And I come from Cesh Carrigan in County Leitrim. No, but I hope you can answer the question without being too diplomatic.
I like the name Rutledge. That's why I use it. It reminds me of that big quarry that's close to Cesh Carrigan.
Thank you. Well, first, thank you for what was, by all means, a great evening. And I wonder, Mr. McGarren, you've once been quoted to me as saying that in your childhood and youth in Roscommon and Leitrim, it was basically regarded as impolite to seem happy, which is something that strikes me as, in my experience, sort of not very untypical of the sort of Roscommon mindscape I've experienced myself. And and now, also in my experience, now up to this book, which I have to admit I haven't managed to read yet, but just what I've heard from it now, up to this book, it didn't seem your character didn't really do happy in a way. Certainly amongst women, it seemed very much that way to me. It seemed very sort of not bleak, but very low-key mindscape. And I wonder now, with this book, have you now discovered the happiness behind the politely unhappy faces, or what is it?
People are determined to make you talk about happiness here tonight. It's not just me.
Actually, that was about the quotation is from an essay that I wrote. And it really was about the middle class that was dominated by a kind of fortress church. And for some reason, in that class, it was thought to be a sign of flightiness or instability to laugh. It was a kind of, I was to a certain extent in that sentence that I wrote, making fun out of it. Because I actually, the exact sentence, as far as I can remember, was that the stolidity of the long, empty, grave face was the height of decorum and profundity. Which plainly, anybody listening to the census would know that I didn't think that. But there was a lot of people going around with long, empty, grave faces. And laughter was considered dangerous.
Mr. McGahan, I just want to ask, would your work output be as great if you had been born in, we'll say, one of the an inner city part of Dublin or any other city? Most of your work is based in rural Ireland. You write beautifully about the rivers, the trees, etc.
Well, I think that it's is that private world that each of us inhabit that we talk about, and that that's an accident. And I think that you could write as interestingly about Ballyfermot or the inner Dublin or Los Angeles or anywhere else, but you'd actually want to know and care about it. And I think that it's what's done with the place, what's actually what the writing does is more important than either the subject matter or the place it comes out of. And I think that everything, interestingly, begins with one person in one place. And it depends on the person more than the place. It's what we make of the place.
Okay, let's take one last question. We have just down here, Siobhan.
Thanks, John. Seeing that it's, you know, it takes so many years between your novels, just very interested from the craft point of view to find out what type of soundboard do you use to do the editing, or is the editing done by yourself, or is it done in association with somebody?
No, it's done by myself. I actually write with a certain type of pencil, and since I'm always trying to get excuses not to write, when I start a novel, I always get 50 of the same type of pencils. So I have no excuse. And at a certain time, which is very close to the end of the work, it's put on a word processor. It's all written. It's the way I began. It's like the place that you own. Words had always a kind of physical presences for me. Is that I think each word has an exact weight and shape and even colour. And it's always fascinated me that if you change one word in a single sentence, that all the other words demand to be rearranged. I get a physical sense of paper and pen, and that's the way I work, which actually places me in time as well.
Your writing, however, is timeless, or whatever about your writing methods. So thank you again for coming here tonight and for talking to us. It's been a pleasure. I think it's been a pleasure for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our producer was Kevin Reynolds, and on sound, Sean Campbell and Kevin Fowley.
Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.